You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is T. Karagason Boyle, Tom Boyle, author most recently of The Road to Wellville. He's a frequent guest on Bookworm, and his other books, which I think everyone knows, include World's End, The Descent of Man, If the River Was Whiskey, East is East, Water Music, Greasy Lake, and Budding Prospects. And this book is set in a town familiar to everyone who grew up in the 50s, Battle Creek, Michigan, where cereal comes from.
Indeed, yes, Michael. And let me just interrupt to say that it's a pleasure to be back on the show for the 612th time now.
The 612th consecutive day.
Battle Creek, Michigan. I think we all in America, perhaps worldwide, know about Battle Creek because we used to cut those little pieces of cardboard off the cereal boxes and mail them in to get our trinkets when we were kids. It had kind of a magical aura to it.
And so cereal, which is now famously our most unhealthful, sugar-filled, caramelized, pink, green, and every pastel color food, begins in Battle Creek at the turn of the century as the inspiration of health nuts.
Exactly.
Who want to fill our bowels with grain and granola and roughage of every type and keep us clean. In other words, our century is the history of something that begins in willed purity and ends in complete degeneration.
And very well said.
This is the story of The Road to Wellville, a book about a bunch of health pilgrims who are faced eventually, as always in a Tom Boyle book, with punishment for trying to protect themselves against anything.
Sure. And, of course, not only was cereal in its first incarnation a health food, but it was also our first fast food, and I think that's why it became so popular at the turn of the century. After all, if you wanted to eat breakfast in the 1890s, well, you had to, you know, go to the barrel of salt pork and get a big slimy piece of it out, fry it up in the pan, and make some flapjacks, and, of course, suffer from indigestion as a result. But here now you had a product that could go on the shelf, and it wouldn't rot. In fact, the cereal companies that that did go out of business in Battle Creek, which was a boom town at the turn of the century, were ones that couldn't quite get the formula right. They couldn't quite bake those flakes enough to dextrinize them and get the moisture out and get the oils out. And they went rancid on the shelves, and so you poured out some rancid flakes into your bowl, and those companies went out of business. As far as the characters are concerned, I think you're right to observe that they do suffer a certain degree of punishment for wanting to purify themselves and live forever. I think that's a sort of a quixotic aim, don't you?
Well, what I've noticed is that there is that anyone who wants to protect himself or herself from the unknown in your book, in any of your books, gets punished. Because the unknown seems to be what we should welcome. The unknown is the future.
I don't know necessarily, Michael. That may be your interpretation. From my own point of view, the unknown is something to avoid. and I would like to be living behind the 200-foot white wall with the moat around it, which is the subject of my next book, by the way. I think, it's a very mysterious universe, and it seems to be ruled by accident. And we hominids want to have a certain degree of control over what goes on moment to moment. Yes, of course, if there were no change and we had absolute control over the future, then things wouldn't be quite so interesting, but they wouldn't be quite so dangerous either. And so I think my characters are doomed to try to fight against the rules of the universe.
I think, though, of this book, begins with the sanitarium, the san, as it's called, where the people are subjected to all sorts of supposedly health-giving regimes, enemas and electrical baths and special diets. And the last book had a kind of similar institution, a writer's workshop. And it seems to be the case that whenever people band together for the betterment of their kind or the perfection of an art, at least in one of your books, this is the sign of almost an invitation to entropy.
I love that interpretation, Michael. In fact, I could take it back to World's End, which, of course, centered around Kichewank Colony, another colony set apart for a very different purpose altogether. It was originally an anarchist colony. And the book that I'm working on now will also deal with a small enclave of people. Maybe the interest for me and fascination is not only in creating a microcosm of a larger society, but in this kind of sealed-away aspect of these special groups or special communities of people. It gives me an opportunity to see what the dangers are that lie outside and inside when you do band together. Maybe you're inviting disaster, as in The Mask of the Red Death, for instance. Can you really escape humanity? Can you escape disease? Can you perfect yourself in the way of the people who went to Dr. Kellogg's San at the turn of the century to mold their bodies?
Well, it's there is, in the first scene, Dr. Kellogg, who is demonstrating to his fearful audience that the porterhouse steak that they can purchase down at the finest restaurant is composed of more bacteria than they could find in a similarly composed and weighted pile of horse flop. And in fact, the demonstration, if taken to its ultimate, would say that the health flop is healthier, something that or at least less.
In Dr. Kellogg's book, sure. I mean, he weighs, he has a pretty young lady come up from the audience and look at the two samples, and obviously there are more bacteria in the meat. That's why we love it so. You know, it's full of rich red blood and putrescence. I mean, it's delicious. But for Dr. Kellogg, this proves conclusively, and to his audience, you know, which is agape at this whole thing, that you know, there are more bacteria in meat. It's worthless. Yeah, you may as well eat horse excrement. Can we say excrement on the air, by the way?
We can say
one of those words
on the air.
Oh, thank God for that.
There aren't all that many of those words, and all of the euphemisms are permissible.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
He calls a monkey. He has a monkey brought up from the audience, and the monkey makes a gargoyle face and rejects the steak as well, delighting in banana after banana, I guess to demonstrate.
Another conclusive demonstration that, you know, we monkeys as a race are not meant to eat meat. The doctor also, this is, by the way, true to historical fact, Dr. Kellogg also had a wolf, which he raised as a vegetarian, to prove that the savage nature of the beast could be tamed if it didn't have to kill and rend flesh. Of course, he had some small problems. You couldn't examine the wolf from too closely because it was dying. Its hair was falling out. Its teeth were falling out. He had a real trouble inventing the right mixture of grains and so on to make a vegetarian wolf. But again, he was trying to prove a point.
He wasn't too successful with his cockatoo either.
In fact, I don't know about that. His cockatoo seemed to survive, but of course it didn't eat meat.
Well, I thought in the last chapter that it seemed, you know, winsome. You have him posed in a photograph with a white cockatoo on his white shoulder. And you do sense that this is a book about the ultimate whiteness, not the whiteness of the whale, but the whiteness of the Midwest.
Again, a wonderful observation. But perhaps this is what fascinated me with the subject. Dr. Kellogg did pose in such a fashion with a white cockatoo. He did dress entirely in white. In fact, he looked most, from our era, like his antithesis, I guess, Colonel Sanders of the Kentucky Fried Chicken concern. He had the same beard and haircut and the same general build, and he did dress entirely in white for that effect. Yeah, there's a blandness, a purity to what he wanted. And we might point out, too, that this is not a sanatorium, you know, where you would go to be cured of where you would be go to be strapped to the wall if you're suffering from mental illnesses, I should say, or cured of tuberculosis. This was a sanitarium, sanitary. He coined the term.
It's a place, in a sense, rather like the terrifying Grad Grind Institute at the beginning of Hard Times. In that book, which begins with another demonstration, a teacher is lecturing to helpless children, among them poor Sissy Jupe, who really just belongs in the circus. She's an aerialist's daughter, and she's been forced to go to school. And Mr. Gradgrind is standing in front of her saying, "Do we want to see a horse on our wallpaper?" And Sissy, who comes from the circus, would like to see a horse on her wallpaper. And Mr. Gradgrind says, "We do not, Sissy Jupe. We do not want a horse on our wallpaper."
Yes, well, these were the Victorians. This is how they taught. This is how they viewed the world. And, of course, Kellogg was born in the 1850s. He's coming out of that tradition. But he was also a progressive. He would certainly be akin fictionally to a Gradgrind and some of Dickens' other more pompous heroes or anti-heroes who would drive their point home ad nauseum. But he was also a scientist, a man who believed in perfecting mankind. A Gradgrind was, if I recall, was something of an imposter in a way, but. Certainly Kellogg believed in everything he was saying, absolutely. From my point of view, of course, and I believe from yours, you wouldn't have made the comparison, this is exactly what we don't want. We don't want people who say, "Give me your will, give me your checkbook, and I will lead you to the promised land," whether they believe in what they're saying or not. I think that leads to trouble for individuals in a free society.
I wanted to talk a bit about the prose style because it seems to me to be a very happy find. In a way, The Road to Wellville, reading its sentences, is like looking through old Sears Roebuck catalogs. One sees objects that, because time has rendered them foreign, have become surrealistic, quaint, and odd. And the prose of the book is a kind of con man spiel. True, it's a con man who believes what he's saying, but in a nice way, the leer and facetiousness of some of your later prose, and earlier for that matter, is nicely matched here by that funny kind of ringmaster language that America perfected for its charitable and eleemosynary institutions.
Well, you used the term happy. I think it is a happy subject for me. The prose is wedded to its time. Of course, the book is set in 1907, and yet one has to realize that the novelist's job is to seduce the reader into believing that this is actual, that this world exists. Without going overboard. I think historical novels often fail because they don't have much relevance to today, and they're written in a very flat way. They try to reproduce history. If that were the aim of the author, then the author might be better served by writing a history or writing an essay about an historical incident. My job, though, is to make you feel that people might speak in this way. And, of course, you mentioned the prose, the narrative voice is one of a huckster. It's one of the themes of the book. We have several hucksters in the book. I'll give you an example in terms of how the research will work into a novel as I see it. I discovered a term of the day that was current through rereading Dreiser. It was a term that meant that something was really terrific. Michael, I just got a new car, you would say, "Hey, really terrific." And the term was out of sight. It was used twice in Sister Carrie by Dreiser. And if I had used out of sight, it would have been totally authentic, but no one would have believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Out of sight. That just doesn't work in 1907. But it was true.
Uh-huh. There are a lot of things like that, and it's partially that they change meaning so much. I mean, our own language, I would imagine one would be hard put to to write a Western now and have the character saying, dude.
Yeah, that would be tough for a while anyway.
Yeah. Dr. Kellogg prescribes to his flock five enemas a day. I have the feeling that this makes him an attractive figure for you.
Yeah, very definitely, because, of course, as you well know, now that we've done so many shows together, I subscribe rigidly to the regimen of five enemas a day, minimum, just to be healthy. And I also subscribe to his notion of abstaining from sex for life.
This is your daughter's graduating.
Well, perhaps I slipped once or twice in there, but the man had an excellent program. He believed that you could control the appetites across the board. And of course, I've written a lot about appetites and controlling the appetites. And so, I was very attracted to some of his regimens. And by the way, you might mention the enema machine, which he created in case that poor abused orifice wasn't getting quite enough of a thorough wash every day. And this brings us back to the white suit and the idea of the sanitarium, a place that was sanitary in every way.
Well, I think more, you see, we've talked about this before, the swamp in East is East, mm-hmm. or the...
or water music, for that matter.
Or water music, or the storm of Orger in an early short story, or the amount of monkey dew that's appeared earlier on. You see, I think that you like Kellogg because you like digging into the pile. I mean, I think this becomes an attraction for you.
I'll admit to it. Absolutely.
What's attractive?
Can we say excrement now?
Sure.
About excrement.
Yes.
You mean? I'm always writing about the bodily functions and the appetites, and this is one result of them. Kellogg, as an historical figure, was totally obsessed with the bowels. So he, of course, made a natural progression in the link of my books for me to write about. And also, of course, impressing this view... a lot of the more quack notions are what attract me to him, too, on his audience. This is gospel truth, just as, our health practitioners and dietitians and health food shop proprietors of today. Of course, there is no actual food in health food shops anymore, just powder, are impressing it on us. I mean, you mentioned earlier the prose reflecting its time. You mentioned it seems like opening a Sears catalog. That's wonderful to me that you would perceive it in that way. That's why I included the old photographs. Imagine going 86 years into the future and looking back on the various treatments we're undergoing today, how bizarre it might seem.
Oh, yes. Well, that's what I mean. It's not just us. I mean, the surrealists themselves like taking old merchandise catalogs to make their collage novels from. I was suggesting that by going into the past makes this novel weirdly modern because the things it finds around the sanitarium in the folk beliefs about health are so peculiar and amusing that they seem like completely outer space inventions.
And yet... they're current today. I mean, that's the fun of it for me. You know, the psyllium seeds that the doctor would feed his patients to scour them out, well, that is Metamucil, you know, mm-hmm. which we use today. The five enemas a day sounds a lot suspiciously like the high colonic to me, you know. You look in the back of Harper's Magazine and you see the good colon and the bad colon, which look pretty much exactly the same, you know, and you worry. You think, my God, does my colon look like that? Well, maybe I should get the high colonic. even here I am standing in opposition to Dr. Kellogg in some way on this book tour. And yet when the New York Times reported a few weeks ago that we needed more vitamin E, you know, my stomach clenched and I thought, well, gee, maybe I should get some more vitamin E. We're all susceptible to this. Everyone we know has some kind of personal theory of health through diet, Everyone has. And it's not based on anything except voodoo and superstition. You could take any of the listeners today and say to them, what's your health regime? Or what do you eat? What is your diet? And they will have one. Everyone will have one. And they will defend it stoutly against the evidence. You just feel it, you know?
Nothing into the idea that the great scatological writers are of Irish descent.
Well, I can, you know, again, I stand accused.
You know, Swift, Joyce,
sure.
Beckett, the shebang.
Well, in a sense, I think all higher conversation is about the bowels.
Truly?
Sure.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, at any philosophical discussion of origins, discussion of the universe, really comes down to the bowels ultimately.
The fundament.
The fundament, exactly. And, you know, again, I'm having a lot of fun with the notions of the parameters of our lives and how we try to prevent the inevitable from occurring and so on and so on, and how this puts us in the hands of quacks, how we're willing to give up our individuality to someone else who supplies the answers for us, the guru of whatever stripe. Kellogg is a guru of health. I mean, there are gurus of politics. There are gurus of religion.
What would you say if I were to say that in addition to this being a historical comedy, a historical satire, that I read it as if it were an American version of Gargantua and Pantagruel?
I'd be delighted.
It leads me to my next question, though, because early on in your writing, one suspected that you would become a provider of stylistic circuses. The lists of Gargantua and Pantagruel, the breaking into rhyme, the different dialects, the digressions. And yet, it seems to me, your books become tighter and tighter and tighter stylistically, more and more controlled.
I think it's perhaps just a growing up as an artist. One then is able to exercise more control over the work. Certainly each book is individual, though, and the style of each book is linked to that book. Perhaps the language of the earlier books, I think of Water Music and Descent of Man in particular, was wilder and less reined in. I think as a novelist, though, my interest is still, of course, essentially in language. I think the language of my books is perhaps unique among that of American writers today in its variety and richness. Of course, I guess that's not for me to say. I hope it is, anyway.
Well, Dr. Kellogg says so.
But I think if the language is a little more tamed, let's say the metaphors, we can count them down. There are fewer than in the very wild earlier writings. I think it's because I hope, anyway, that the books are becoming more of an integrated whole. I think the earlier books may have sacrificed character to language to an extent. And perhaps now I've become more interested in integrating all the aspects of a book in one. I hope that to satisfy you, Michael, and others who may be yearning for something more like Water Music, to perhaps come up with something that's as wild as that in the future. You know, one only goes from book to book.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that knowing the variety of your abilities, I kept hoping, for instance, to read Eleanor's Secret Diaries. Mm. I wanted to hear Boyle do the language of 19th century amour. I know that you can, and I know that in another kind of book...
Wait for the sequel. No, Michael, you have to realize, I think that's interesting, but each reader will write his own book, obviously, but will also want something or take it in a different direction. I can only say that I have to be true to what I see at that moment. Obviously, this material to me is so fitting, as you've observed, and so rich that... I could have written a book three times as long. There are other wonderful characters who appear in the book whom I've barely been able to scratch the surface of, like the C.W. Post, for instance, who appears as a sort of a ghostly presence in the book, or Horace B. Fletcher, the man who believed in Fletcherizing, that is, chewing your food 100 times until it disappeared in saliva, and all you actually ate was flavored saliva. These characters are wonderfully rich, and yes, it would have been fun to delve into Eleanor's sexuality through her point of view a little bit more, but it didn't lie within the ken of this novel exactly. As I see the novel, it deals with hucksterism on three levels, the levels of the three primary characters and how they deal with it. And again, you observed earlier that this is peculiarly American. I think so. I think it is in the tradition of Mark Twain as well as Gargantua and Pantagruel in terms of the sheer quantity of excrement, as you say. But also in terms of, I think Twain would have liked this book because of its exploration of this American phenomenon of the huckster, the man who has the goods. Charlie Ossining, whom we haven't mentioned, one of the main characters who forms a cereal company, and his mentor, Goodloe H. Bender, who is the supreme huckster of all. But Dr. Kellogg himself is a huckster. So is C.W. Post. So are all these characters.
And in fact, I remember a teacher once saying to me, until you prove yourself to be an honorable man, you will always sound like a rascal. And in this book, everyone sounds like a rascal, at least for a while.
Except for Will Lightbody, whom I view as the hero of the book. He is the character upon... he's the everyman. He's the poor guy whose only sin is that he loves his wife too much, and she is a health nut of the first degree. He is the character upon whom all of these bizarre treatments are inflicted, and the man who rises in his own small way above it for one small moment. To me, that's sufficient to be a hero.
The hero is Fall Guy.
Yes, sure.
Well, you know, other people would call this victim.
Well, again, you have to qualify what you mean by hero. A critic in reviewing this on the front page of the New York Times Book Review found that there were really no heroes, that there was an ensemble cast and so on and so on. That's fine with me. Or they were anti-heroes. So did the interviewer who came out in the same issue. It plays right into my hand since the next book, a collection, is called Without a Hero. That's all right. I still see Will Lightbody as being heroic here. In terms of the way I view the universe, we don't really have much definition of what is heroic in our lives or much opportunity to be heroic. Heroism is certainly not what we received as children post-war, you know, the propaganda movies in which, you know, the hero was a Marine and he killed 400 of the enemy single-handedly and dragged his buddies up the hill and so on. I suppose that goes on. But not in my universe. In my universe, all the forces are gathered against you. And if you can rise this far occasionally, you're doing very well. But usually, since for comic purposes, the forces are arrayed impossibly against you in my books. Even getting that far is pretty good.
I've been talking to T.C. Boyle, Tom Boyle, the author most recently of The Road to Wellville, published by Viking. Thank you again for making your way here. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
And say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.